Well, good morning. My name is Dean Folks. I'm the lead pastor here at LifePoint, and you have come on the last Sunday of our Now Playing series, where every year we take four Sundays and we look at the collision of faith and film. It's a big day all around here at our church. At 9:30, at the previous service to you, we had 150 students who had been at C3 weekend, 6th grade through 12th grade, had one of our students baptized this morning. Out of that weekend. And so if you look around and you see a little extra popcorn on the ground or something like that, there were no seats in here today at 9:30. And I'll say as well, it's a good opportunity for us just to take a chance and say thanks to all the volunteers. I know our ladies from our ladies' life groups that meet here on Tuesday mornings, they've been restocking candy and soda and all that during the week. Alan Wolliver, Maddie and Tressa, their family, they work really hard. Alan gets here at 6:15 on Sundays, all 4 weeks, starts popping popcorn at 6:15, pops popcorn all the way through till noon for us. I know Pastor Shane buys all the candy and gets it all here on time and in the right spots to make all this happen. So if you don't mind, let's just take a minute and say thanks to them. And I also know this morning that doing Lord of the Rings, there are probably a few of you who are a little bit disappointed that it's me doing the teaching instead of Pastor Kale from our Delaware campus, who is, I don't think it's too strong of a way to say that he's a little bit of a Lord of the Rings nerd. I don't think it's too strong. He's tried to get it in the last couple of years. It's been in the voting the last couple of years, and it didn't win either year, and he was very disappointed about that. So this year, he set up the categories in the Oscars edition, and Lord of the Rings won the Oscar for best score. So that's why we're doing it today. And there was no limit to how many times you could vote. I think he voted over 100 times to make sure we did Lord of the Rings this year. He was so excited about doing it. Is it weird if you own like a real Hobbit sword? Is that weird? Because he has two of them at his house. So I'll give you my limited understanding of Lord of the Rings. You know, it's a trilogy of films written, the original books are written by J.R.R. Tolkien, called the novel of the century for the previous century. It's a different form of literature. It's a quest. There are nine men who come together because one of them, a hobbit from the Shire named Frodo Baggins, is tasked with this opportunity along with these other eight individuals to destroy the Ring of Power, to throw it into the fires of Mount Doom, which are ruled by the evil Lord Sauron, who wants to seize the ring and seize power over all of Middle Earth. Of course, Frodo's quest, along with his best friend Samwise, and there were Merry and Pip and Aragorn and Boromir and Gimli and Legolas and all the ladies like Legolas, right? We're going to throw him in there. All nine of them with Gandalf, kind of the older, wiser leader, they are on this quest to see Middle Earth through to restore Aragorn to his rightful place as the king of Middle Earth. And by the time you get to the end of this film, it has this idea, this sense of home. It's really a concept, a theme that runs through all three films, that everybody has a place that you call home. And for Frodo, it's consistently in the movies, he wants to go back to the Shire, back to the Shire, back to the Shire. But what he finds out is that his home is not so much a place as it is a quest with a group of people to do something that's going to be eternally meaningful and make a difference in the lives of others. This really comes right out of the life of Tolkien. He was drafted. He grew up in rural England, maybe a Shire-ish kind of place, and he was drafted into the army, into World War I. He fought for the United Kingdom, and he fought in the Battle of Somme, S-O-M-M-E, if you know much about World War I and its history. That was the bloodiest battle, one of the bloodiest battles in world history, over 1 million casualties in that battle. Tolkien witnessed that. He lived out what it was like to fight for a cause with a group of people. So what we're going to kind of jump off from this point, this idea today, is that theologically speaking, everybody has a home. Everybody has something, someone, someplace that you run to, that you are pursuing. And Jesus, in Luke chapter 15, Jesus tells a story about home. Now, when I say a story, you know, a lot of Jesus's stories are referred to as parables. And early on in ministry, for me, one of the first books I ever bought was a book by a guy named Herbert Lockyer called All the Parables of the Bible. And when I read this about Luke chapter 15, Lockyer says that Luke chapter 15 is one parable with three different chapters. It's not three different parables like we tend to treat them. It's one parable, one story with three chapters. But what makes Jesus's telling of the parable really difficult is his audience. So let me read it to you. Luke chapter 15, verse 1. And we'll jump in there. Now the tax collectors and sinners were drawing near to him. And the Pharisees and scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So what you see here is that Jesus has two very different groups of people, right, in his audience. On the one hand, he's got the Pharisees. And on the other hand, it says that there are tax collectors and sinners. I know we're all probably working on our taxes right now. So if you're here today and you work for the IRS, I just want you to know Jesus made a special classification of sin for you, right? For you and your job. Now, you know, in their world, the tax collectors, they worked for Rome, stole money from their own people, the Hebrews, and pocketed the money. So that was like the worst of the worst. Tax collectors, you lump in all of the known sinners that you could think of in their world, and that's who Jesus is talking to. So basically, you've got the Pharisees who wrote the religious laws, and then you've got this group of sinners who broke all of the religious laws. That's who Jesus is talking to. Very different groups. The Pharisees, sometimes they get a bad rap, in my opinion. They would kind of be like the church member of your dreams in some ways. They went to church five times a day. They prayed five times a day. They gave an offering every day. They kept every single rule. They just did everything right. But they did everything right for all the wrong reasons. And then on the other hand, these tax collectors and sinners, they just felt less than because of the Pharisees and because of the scribes. And so what Jesus does is he starts this day to sit down and share a teaching. And the teaching, Jesus says, in chapter 1 of his parable, he says is a story about a shepherd. He said there's a shepherd who has 100 sheep, and at the end of the day, he counts them up. 96, 97, 98, 99, and he's missing one. So I'm guessing he probably counted them again. 96, 97, 98, 99, and he's missing one sheep. He's got 99%, right? Some of you here today are college students, you're high school students, you're coming up on spring break, and before that, you're gonna have exams. And if I told you, you could have a 99%, right? You'd take it, right? You'd take that deal right now. Some of you would take 79%, like right now, wouldn't you? You know, 99% he's got, but Jesus says that this shepherd is different, that he leaves the 99 sheep and he goes out and wanders out into the far dark night to go find this one lamb. And when he finds this lamb who had wandered far away, he brings him back. And when he brings him back, he throws a party. That's chapter 1. Chapter 2, Jesus tells a story about a woman who loses a coin. Now, in their culture, this is more than just like losing a penny, right? Ladies would wear around their forehead at times a group of coins that were representative of like an engagement ring. If you ladies can imagine, instead of wearing an engagement ring on your finger, it would be like wearing a band around your head with a big diamond right here in the front. Some of y'all like that, right? And so that's what she lost. She lost a coin or coins from that, which would have kind of been the symbol maybe of a broken engagement or something going wrong. And so Jesus says in the story that she cleans her house top to bottom till she finds that coin. And when she does, she throws a party. Now you see a theme developing, right? These stories that Jesus are telling, they're about two things: lostness and parties. Struggle, fight, and celebration. Then Jesus comes to the third chapter of the parable, and he's gonna tell a story about two lost sons. And really, the story is going to center around sibling rivalry. And before we talk about it, I'll just say some of you in the room, you know what that's like. If you're here today and you're a younger person, you know what it's like to consistently feel like you fight brother against brother, brother and sister, and y'all just bicker at each other and your parents hate it. And so there's that. But also, some of you know what it's like for sibling rivalry to extend long beyond childhood. And there are families here today that are fractured because brothers and sisters, because they cannot get along with one another. You know the pain of that. So Jesus tells a story. I could say it to you in two different ways. I'll give you two examples. One is the story of Adi and Ruta Dassler. I'll show you their picture up here. They grew up in Germany in the 1920s. And as they grew up, they started a shoe business. Now, Ruta, he was the older brother. He did everything right. He was the accountant of the business. He kept all the T's crossed, I's dotted. He joined the Nazi party. Adi eventually came along and joined. But Ruta was a strong, strict Nazi all the way through the war, did everything just right. Adi, his younger brother, he was kind of along for the ride. He was kind of the sales guy of the shoe business. And he tried to, you know, be there on time, but he's always a little bit late, you know, and arriving. Well, something happened in World War II when these two brothers and their families were in a bunker together. Something was said, and after the war, they were completely divided. There was sibling rivalry, fractured their family. So much so after the war that Ruta, who was kind of the brains behind the business, he told Adi, I'm leaving the business. I'm starting my own company. You can have it. So Adi had to keep the shoe business. So he renamed it. You know what he renamed it? Adi Das. Adidas. So he did pretty well, right? And you think about Ruta, and Ruta started a shoe company called Ruta, which is not a great name, right? So eventually, he renamed his shoe company from Ruta to Puma. Two incredibly successful brothers, right? Incredibly gifted men, fractured for the rest of their lives. I'll give you a more modern version of the story. And by modern, it'll just be modern for some of us maybe who are a little older. But back in the 1990s, there was a show that was incredibly popular that had this kind of sibling rivalry. If you remember, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Now this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down. And I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became the prince of a town called Bel-Air.
So if you remember, Will and Carlton, right? They fit this mold perfectly. Two guys living under the same roof, same family. And Carlton, the older one of the two, he does everything perfect, right? Everything right. He's straight A's, National Honor Society. Would have had a perfect credit report. He always kept the rules. And then there was Will. And Will's like a member of no dean's list, no honor society. He's a good guy, but he just wants to have fun. Doesn't need to have A's. Who needs A's, B's, C's and D's, anything on the line, as long as it's a good time. Well, Jesus tells a story about two brothers, just like Carlton and Will. In this family, two brothers. There's an older brother who does everything right, and then there's a younger brother who just wants to have fun. And as Jesus tells the story, here's how he says it. He says that one day the younger brother comes to his father, and the younger brother says, I want my share of the inheritance now. Now, in their culture, this would have been humiliating to his father. Because basically what he was saying is, I wish you were dead. I want my money now. Terribly humiliating to his father. But the father was gracious. And he gave him his third, right? The older son would have gotten two-thirds of the inheritance. The younger son would have gotten a third. He gives him his third of the inheritance, and the younger son goes into what Jesus calls a far country, and he wastes all of the money. We would say he went to Vegas, right? He went to Vegas, enjoyed everything there is to enjoy in Vegas until he ran out of money, and all of a sudden there's a famine in the far country. And when there's a famine there, he has to take a job slopping hogs. Now, I want you to think about in their culture, pigs were the most unclean of unclean animals. So not only does he take a job slopping hogs, but he can't find enough food to eat. So his heart longed for the food, for the hog slop that he was feeding to the pigs. Now, push pause right here. The Pharisees would have loved this story. They would have been like, Jesus, if you would teach stories like this all the time, man, we would support you, because obviously the younger son is showing his lust for pleasure like the tax collectors and the other known sinners. And the Pharisees would have said, Jesus, way to go with this story, man. Keep this teaching. Keep it up. But as Jesus tells the story, eventually the son who's in a hog pen, eventually the son who wants to eat pig slop, says to himself, what am I doing? And he makes what I'm going to call the home decision. He says, you know what? I could get up out of here and I could go home. I could, and it's going to be embarrassing, and I'm going to have to swallow my pride, and I'm going to have to humble myself, but I can go home. And so he gets up and he heads home. And on the way, he works on his speech, because that's what kids do when they get in trouble and they find out their parents know about it, right? He thinks, oh, what am I going to say? So he starts working on his speech. And here's how his speech goes. He says, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. Make me as one of your hired servants. Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. Make me one of your hired servants. Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. That's what I'm going to say. Now, meanwhile, back at literally the ranch, back at home, what the son doesn't know is that nightly the father is looking for him. That he looks over, sits on the edge of his porch, and he looks down the road. And every now and then he'll see somebody walking on the road, and he'll think, maybe that's him. Maybe that's, no, it's not him. Sometimes maybe the wind is blowing down there, and there's some sand in the wind, and he's like, I think I see something. No, that's not him. But Jesus says one night the father looks off the porch, and he sees somebody down there, and he thinks, nah, I can't be. And he gets closer. Man, he's about Junior's height, and he kind of walks like Junior. And all of a sudden, he realizes that his son has come home. Now, to some of us, this is just a story. To some of us, this moment has happened in your family. And you know what it's like when somebody who has been estranged from your family comes home. Now, the father's got a decision to make. And really, that's what the story in a lot of ways is about. It's not about the kid. It's about the father. He's got a decision to make. How's he going to handle this? He's got options, because the Pharisees made rules for him to have options. One of the options in their culture was that he could have stoned his son to death. As an example of a way how you don't respond to your parents. He could have lectured him. You ever been in that spot? You ever know you've done something wrong and you're going back and you're gonna get the lecture? That's what he could have done. Could have just waited up there on the porch. But you know what Jesus says the father does? He jumps off the edge of the porch and he runs down the road and he meets his son. And I'm trying to think about what the son is like. You remember Pigpen on Charlie Brown? Remember him? There's all the little flies buzzing around him. He's always kind of dirty, and he's always, that's what I think the son is like. And it says that the father falls on his son's neck and he kisses him. And I love it that the son, if you read the text, the son starts a speech. He says, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. The father stops him right in mid-speech. He doesn't get to the, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. I called your son, make me one of your hired servants. He didn't even get to that part, because the father stops him and he says, I need a robe, I need a ring, and I need shoes. Because this my son who was lost is now found. Somebody go grab the fattest cow we've got. We're going to take it down and we're going to throw a party like no other party we've ever had, because my son has come home. I wish the story just ended like that. Like that was the end of it. It'd be great, right? Happy ending, everybody's. But it doesn't end there. Because Jesus goes on to say that during the party, Carlton comes home. The older brother comes back, and he's not happy. As a matter of fact, let me read you part of the conversation between the father and the older brother in verses 28 through 30. But he being the older brother, was angry and refused to go into the party. His father came out and entreated him or begged him, but he answered his father, "Look, these many years I have served you and I never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him." So the older brother comes in and he sees the party, and the father comes out and he says, "Man, you're never gonna believe it. Your brother's home." And the older brother's thinking, "I wish he never came home." And what he says to his father, it's chronic resentment. He says, no way. I will not dance. I will not sing. Because look at everything he did wrong. It's chronic complaining. "You never gave me a goat. You killed a fattened calf for him. You never even gave me a goat." And I know the father's like, I'm sure his mind is blown at this point. He's like, "Man, the music's really loud from the party. I didn't hear what you said. Did you say boat? Did you say you wanted a boat? Because it sounded like you said goat. And I'm sure we're not arguing about a goat right now." Just as humiliating as the younger son taking a third of the inheritance and wasting it, it would have been just as humiliating for the older son, who should have been running the party, by the way, culturally speaking, to refuse his father to go in and to scold his father this way. It would have been just as humiliating in terms of how the older son treated him and how the younger son also treated his father. So the story wraps like that. Two sons, one who's home, and the other one who sits just outside of home. The one son who wandered into the far country, his sins are obvious. His lust for pleasure is obvious. But what is so much more subtle is the older brother's tendency, not for pleasure, but for power. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite authors, a guy named Tim Keller, has coined a term called elder brotherism. And Keller says that it is a subtle sin that is rampant in our churches. That somehow we think that we can leverage God with our good works and good deeds, and that compared to other people who are in the far country, who find themselves in the hog pen, we do so much better, that somehow we could lever God to be good to us, to give us what we think we deserve because of our good works and the things that we are out there doing and how we're out there serving, and how some way we think that we can earn it, that we can be good enough. And power and control is so incredibly dangerous in our lives. If you're here today and you're in middle school, you know power and control. In every middle school, there's a queen bee, right? There's a little gal running around that middle school somewhere who tries to control everybody and who wants to be the center of attention. That's just power and control. If you're in a high school, every high school has got one guy who thinks that he's in charge of the whole school and he'll do whatever he has to do to bully people, to move people. He will hurt people's feelings, shut people out, bring people in. He'll work the crowd because he wants to be in control. He wants power. You know it if you're an adult. You have seen the devastating effects of power and control, and how people who try and use power to manipulate and move people and create and change situations and make the outcomes work exactly the way they want to end up isolating themselves because they always have to be right. Everyone always has to follow their plan. You've seen the effects of power and control just like we see them in this narrative that Jesus told. So how then do we fight it? How do we fight the effects of power and control? And it's longer term conclusions and the residue, the wake that it leaves behind other people and, quite frankly, our own lives. All of us are gonna have a tendency towards one or the other, towards rebellion or religion, towards pleasure or towards power. We're all gonna fall one way or the other. So how do we deal with it? Can I tell you one thing that's gonna be critically important for all of us is that we all need a tribe. We all need a group. We all need a squad. We call them life groups here at our church. You need a smaller group of people who you are willing to surround your life with, who can speak into your life, because we all have blind spots. The biggest problem that you and I have is that we're self-deceived. And we don't know how self-deceived we are, so we need other people to help us see it. I cannot encourage you strongly enough to be in a group and to give other people access to your life. Angie and I, we've been married 23 years ago yesterday. Yesterday was our 23-year anniversary. And we've got a little bit of a running joke in our marriage about this concept of we, right? Whenever Angie says, we need to do something, I know that she doesn't literally mean we are going to do it. We doesn't mean two. We tends to mean me, that I am going to do something. About 7 or 8 years ago, we got a real heavy snowfall in the winter, about 8 inches, if I remember correctly. It's real wet, heavy. And so I went out and I shoveled our driveway and I shoveled off our sidewalks. And I was just finishing up the bottom of the driveway, getting all the snow out. And Angie just peeked out the door. I mean, I was worn out. Angie peeks out the door and she says, hey, you know what? We should go across the street and shovel Miranda's driveway. Now, Miranda was a single mom who lived across the street from us. And I looked at Angie and I said, we only own one snow shovel. And only one of us and we is out here shoveling right now. But you know what I did? I went and I shoveled Miranda's driveway and shoveled her side. And Angie was right. It was a blind spot for me. I never would have seen the opportunity to do good without her showing that to me. Everybody needs a tribe, a group, a squad who can see into your life, speak into your life on a regular basis. If not, you are going to get tripped up by either pleasure or power. One of the two. It kind of brings you to the end of the parable. You know, one of the things that's interesting to me, and Lockyer says this in his book, one of the things that's interesting to me is it's the parable of the lost sons, plural. We call it the prodigal son, but there were two lost sons in the story. You know that little lamb in chapter 1, the little sheep? Where did it get lost? It wandered far, far away, right? Just like Junior got lost in a far country, wandered off to Vegas, and he was lost far away from home. But remember chapter 2, the lady who lost her coin? Where was that coin lost? It was lost at home. Just like the older brother in the story was lost at home. Two sons, representative of all of us in some form or fashion, representative of all of our lostness, our sinfulness, our brokenness, all of us needing to come home to a father. Why? Because just like both of those boys, your sin and my sin is publicly humiliating to our Creator. Just like they humiliated their father, we humiliate God with the things that we have done wrong. Now listen, do certain sins have worse consequences than other sins? Absolutely, I understand that. But sin is sin. God is holy. He's perfect. We're not. And so instead of saying to us, you've got to do X, Y, and Z, instead of saying to us, you've got to do this to pay for your sin, and this to pay for your sin, and this to pay for your sin, our God got off of his throne in heaven and came to earth and publicly humiliated himself on a cross, crucified naked on a cross, so that the humiliation that our sin brought him, he just took it all onto himself on the cross. Why would he do that? So that you and I could come home to God, to make a way. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father. Me might as well have said, no one comes home except you come by me. So maybe you're here today, and maybe you find yourself today in a hog pen. And the circumstances couldn't be any worse, and the consequences couldn't be any worse. Today you can come home. Maybe you're here today and you find yourself in a pretty good spot because you're a pretty disciplined person and you do things right and you follow all the rules, but your life, as good as it seems, is empty on the inside because it's really all willpower on your part. Today, you can come home. Listen, there is nothing, because I know what some of you are thinking, Dean, if you knew the things that I had done, like this roof is probably gonna cave in today because I stepped into church. If you knew that, listen, you can't do anything so bad as to make God love you any less. And you can't do anything so good as to make God love you anymore. He has given his one and only son as a sacrifice, a ransom, a payment for our sins. If you've never experienced the love of God through the person of Christ, if you've never come home to him, I want to invite you to do that today. Let's pray together. God, thank you that you are our grace and you are our hope and you are our security. You're the one and only thing, God, worth running to. And God, so I pray for people who are here today, Lord, who for whatever reason, God, maybe they've run to other things and I don't know where they find themselves today, but maybe God for them, today is the day that they come home to you. As we just continue to pray right now, stay in that spirit, that attitude of prayer, if that's you and today you want to come home to God through the person of Christ, you want to become a Christian today, I'm going to pray up here. You can pray with me right there in your seat. You don't have to say it exactly like I say it. It's really more the thought and intent of your heart to come home to God through Christ. Give him authority and control of your life. Pray something like this. Dear Jesus, thank you for being the ransom, the payment for my sins. Jesus, please forgive me of my sins. Thank you for dying for me. Thank you for paying the penalty for the sins that I committed. Jesus, today I'm saying that I turn to you, that I run to you, that I want to be yours. You'll be the leader, I'll be the follower. Thank you for your incredible love. Lord, I know that you hear the prayers of your people. And so this morning I pray that the folks who this morning have prayed with me to receive you, Lord, that those prayers would rise fragrant aroma to you. I pray, God, for those of us who call ourselves yours but have that tendency, God, towards pleasure or power to get tripped up, that this morning, God, that we would repent, that we would turn and we would run to you because of your great, incredible love for us on the cross.